In 1864, Scotsman Alexander Russell wrote, "The salmon is the free gift of nature. Its importance as an article of food has been undervalued or overlooked. That long ago thought leads us to ask, can we have our salmon and eat it too?"
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1224th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lyon who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, as the Scotsman Russell wrote so long ago, salmon really are a free gift of nature. They bring us the nutrient riches of the sea right to our dinner table in the most deliciously concentrated form imaginable. Little wonder, then, that we have been eating away at them throughout our history here on planet Earth. And little wonder also that when compared to other sources of nature's vital nutrients, we attribute so much value to them. How much value? Well, the current price for a Chinook salmon pulled from the waters of the Monterey Bay is $26 a pound on the dock. And we pay the price because we believe the salmon is worth it. Given the value that we the people attribute to salmon, you would think we would do our human best to husband the species and its resources to the best of our ability, but we don't. Instead, we dam its rivers and pollute its waters to the extent that we wonder if the species can survive. And that really does lead us to ask, can we have our salmon and eat them too? And who better to ask than Mark Kurlansky, who is the author of Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of Their Common Fate. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Well, it's good to have you. Well, let's see, oysters, cod, pilgrim food, milk, and now salmon. You wrote a great, big, huge, giant, beautiful book, stunningly illustrated with photographs. It could be salmon porno.
If you were a salmon.
Yeah, there you go. Or a salmon lover, maybe even. But pretty darn close. It's a stunning book. It's a big, huge, giant, beautiful book.
Thanks.
But, Mark, why salmon? I mean, you write on these other subjects, oysters, cod, pilgrim, milk, and I always love you have you on to tell their story, because what I really hear is that it's more of a story of we the people than of salmon.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, in 1997, I came out with cod, and that was at a time when the northern cod stocks had collapsed on the Grand Banks, and people for the first time started really thinking about overfishing and fishery management. I said people, meaning the general public, because when I was working as a commercial fisherman way back in the 1960s, it was about all fishermen ever talked about. But now people were aware of this problem. And in following what was going on in fisheries after they tried to manage them better and reduce overfishing, it became increasingly clear to me that, you know, this is just one small problem. And, you know, a fishery where the only problem was overfishing would be a dream and be the easiest thing to fix in the world, especially with salmon, because salmon are very easy to regulate because we know what they do and when they're doing it. But it became clear that there was a lot more going on, and that is why places that restricted the takes on cod and other fishes did not make the fish come back. And I thought that salmon was the perfect vehicle for illustrating this problem. Salmon is an anadromous fish, a fish that lives partly in freshwater rivers and partly at sea, and because of that, it is damaged by absolutely everything we do on Earth, what we're doing to the land and what we're doing to the sea. And the list of problems. And by the way, by and large, overfishing isn't one of them anymore. It's pretty much under control. But we have to deal with problems like urban sprawl, deforestation, bad farming practices, pollution, dams, and climate change, and climate change, and climate change. And
so do you think that, that salmon are like the canaries in a mine?
Yes, exactly. If you, to save salmon, what you have to do is stop doing all the bad things we're doing. So basically, to save salmon, you just have to save the planet, or to put it
So there's the title of your book, Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of Their Common Fate.
Right.
Save the Earth, we might save the salmon.
Right.
Oh, that's easy.
We can save the salmon. Yeah, right.
Easy as that. Well, there you are, folks. You want to have the salmon? Well, that's fine, but you have to save the Earth. And so let's get to work. First of all, let's take a quick look at salmon, which is always fun to do, because there's something about salmon. First of all, you know, so many different critters, we included, eat them. So they're kind of at a nexus of all kinds of different people and organisms and critters and whatnot.
Yeah, you know, Darwin wrote about how every species was important to other species, and when you lose a species, it threatens a lot of other species. What today is called biodiversity, which was not a word Darwin used. It's a word from the 1980s. But all species aren't equal. Some species are more important to other species than others. And salmon is an extremely important species. Salmon keep rivers fertile. Heron, eagles, mergansers, lots of birds depend on them. Insects, bears, sea mammals, just a huge number of animal species depend on the salmon. And if there were no more salmon, the salmon rivers would basically die.
Well, in that regard, it would certainly, the salmon would certainly give Napoleon the pig a run for its money when it comes to which critters are created most equal then. Here's a critter that is at the nexus of so many different critters' lives and the earth as well. So the species itself, what distinguishes salmon from tuna?
You know, I say in the book that I'm not writing this book because salmon is just this incredible animal that we would be very sad if it disappeared. But it is an incredible animal. It is one of the most incredible animals. I mean, it is raised in the rivers and then lives at sea, goes to sea, gains 95% of its weight out at sea, comes back into the river, doesn't eat once it enters the river, which is an interesting question for fly fishermen. but if it did eat, it would completely clean out the river. So it doesn't eat, and it just lives on the fat and protein that is accumulated at sea.
Which would be a good indication of when one would want to catch them in order to eat them, right?
Well, you want to catch them right after they enter the river because, they just use themselves up. They can jump 11 feet in the air, which, I mean, think about that. Isn't that like a human being jumping 50 feet in the air, or, you know, relative to size? And they accelerate faster than a car. Although somebody corrected me and said Teslas are faster than salmon. I don't know. just an incredible animal. And they they change when they're in the water, and they you know, they leave waterfalls or dams or whatever is in their way. They're unstoppable. They're so determined. They completely change their color. They become very red. They develop humps and hook noses. Different species are different.
Their entire physical appearance changes.
Yeah.
They become another fish almost.
Yeah, and Darwin was puzzled by this, because Darwin deeply believed that in nature nothing happens without a reason. So he wondered, why are they doing this? He also wondered why beetles develop horns that they never use for fighting, and why peacocks have these elaborate feathers. And he eventually realized that it's to attract females.
Of course.
This was Darwin's most unpopular idea. You know, evolution was a big hit compared to this one, because Victorian men did not like the idea that men dress up to attract women. And, you know, they change so outlandishly. You know, it's like some guy in this very gaudy plaid suit, and you say, why are you dressed like that? And he says, oh, the girls really like it. Only they really do.
There you go.
But it takes an enormous amount of energy to do this, because that bright red color comes from the pigment of their flesh. So that a salmon that is spawned is white, its flesh is, it no longer has any pigment to it. They just do everything imaginable to reproduce, and they return. I mean, first of all, just think of the fact that from thousands of miles out at sea, they not only find the river of their birth, but the exact location in that river where they were born. And then they finally spawn, and they have nothing left, and they roll over and die. They've done what was their mission.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I always think that, you know, the salmon story could have been written by a Greek tragedian.
There it goes. And it's almost true. Well, we got to have to take a quick break here shortly. But what's the difference between an Atlantic salmon and a Pacific salmon?
Well, they're different genera. They're okay. two different genus, and the Atlantic genus Salmo only have one type of salmon. The Pacific Ocorhynchus have seven different species of salmon, but they're all different. And you know, the extraordinary thing that allows salmon to survive is that every salmon evolves in the river that it deals with.
Ah.
You know, if the river has lots of falls, they have better jumping skills, so they have to go around fast turns.
That's a wonderful notion that I'd like to pick up when we come back from this break. But it's so significant to salmon, and probably no other fish that we know of.
Yes.
Because they come from thousands of miles away to find that one place
Right. Where
they were born.
And the place where they are specifically suited for
to
that
do.
Type of strong current to swim
and
against.
And the time at which they have to show up, too. This is the Food
yes.
Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Mark Kurlansky. Today we're talking about salmon. Can we have our salmon and eat it, too? That's the question on the table. And if you're like me, you hope the answer is yes. Right back.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, today we're eating up a book on salmon, written by Mark Kurlansky and richly illustrated with incredible photographs. I was almost thinking it could be a coffee table book, but it's too interesting to be a coffee table book because nobody really reads coffee table books.
Exactly.
They kind of pick them up and look at them and put them down again. But this book could be a coffee table book because it has illustrations that will keep you entertained for a long time, but then it has interesting stories about our favorite fish. And Mark Kurlansky, how long did it take you to put this one together?
Well, you know, longer than any other book I've ever done. This is actually my 33rd book. It took me about 5 years, but part of that is because salmon is seasonal. And I have a habit of working on several books at once, so I would work on other things in the off-season and focus on salmon, you know, from April to October.
Mm-hmm. And there you go. And with that thought in mind of the seasonality of salmon, let's pick that up again. And we were talking about the kind of the incredible drive salmon have to return to their river, to their place.
Yeah,
of birth.
I mean, some of these currents are incredibly strong, and there are places where you can watch it. Like there's a place in the Gaspé where there's an underground window looking out at the St. Lawrence, and you can see these fish swimming against the current, you know, and gaining centimeters, just, you know, putting their head into the current and not giving up. Unbelievable fortitude and determination.
And they have to get home. They have to spawn. They have to reproduce. And the reproduced salmon are called what, fry?
Well, eventually. I mean, they're originally called eggs.
Eggs first, yeah.
Then alvin, and then fry, par, smolts. Smolts go to sea. Smolts are about the size of a herring.
And on their way out to sea, they must be smolt then, huh?
Yes, they go to the estuary, to the, you know, the head of the river, and they kind of change there to prepare for sea lights. They develop in the rivers. They have spotted or striped skins, a lot like trout, which is good camouflage.
Hide them from the birds
in the river, from the birds and the bears and all that stuff, and. Then in the mouth of the river, before they go to sea, they develop these silver skins, which is what they have the whole time they're at sea.
And silver being the ideal camouflage for the sea.
Right.
And then as they go out to sea, as smolt...
They also, by the way, have to kind of change their biology to become a saltwater animal instead of a freshwater animal.
Has there been any research on how exactly they do that? I mean, think of what we would have to go through to drink salt water instead of fresh water.
Yeah, I mean, their gills change and their whole system and their chemistry changes.
Hmm. Interesting. I wonder if Darwin looked at that. It must have been, that would have been a very interesting one.
You know, in Darwin's day, they didn't really know a lot about salmon. They didn't understand that, you know, they see a salmon, you know, the smolt go out to sea, and then they see these big salmon come back a few months later, and they think it was the same fish.
Right.
They didn't understand that it was a whole other generation. They didn't understand that they traveled thousands of miles in the ocean and were out there for years.
What do we know about the salmon's life at sea? I mean, and how would we know it?
We don't know that much about it, actually. Scientists have been trying to find out more, learning about migration patterns. It's actually very important for managing fisheries because to manage the fishery, you have to know what rivers these fish come from, so that Greenland does not have any rivers with salmon in it, but they have a lot of salmon off of Greenland, and there used to be fishermen fishing them. And then people in France and some other countries said, wait a minute, those are our fish you're taking. It was a big fight between Americans and Canadians, because Americans would capture sockeye in Puget Sound, and this was actually fish that belonged to the Fraser River in British Columbia. So Americans were taking Canadian fish. And, you know, it became an established legal principle that the fish belonged to the river they were born in.
Ah.
But you have to know what river that is.
Yeah, and how would you know if you're a fisherman which river's fish you're catching?
Right, right. It's a big problem, and the solution has generally been to stop fishing at sea. Most salmon are not caught at sea. I mean, they're caught
on the river.
What they do is, you know, you can see them go into the river. You know, they have towers, or sometimes they use aircraft. But I've done it. You know, you can just see them going into the river, and you can count them. And when you have counted enough fish in the river to spawn, you can tell the fishermen who are just offshore that they can catch for a certain number of hours.
Right.
And that's how they regulate it.
Good. And we'll pick that up a little bit down the line then. Do we know how long they stay at sea?
Well, it depends on the species. But some of them are for 3 or 4 years. Some of them are a little less.
Okay, there you go. And then when they return, they're looking for that one specific river. How do they know which river is which?
Ah, that is the great mystery. And there's a lot of theories, but nobody's really sure. It's not only how do they know. They suspect they know, they recognize the river by smell, because salmon have a very acute sense of smell. But the bigger question is, how do they find the river? And there's a lot of theories on that, including some scientists believe that they have an ability to navigate through magnetic fields.
Wow. And is that kind of like birds?
Is that
kind of a parallel theory there? I've heard that birds, you know, have that sense.
Some birds. Yeah. The theory is that they're, you know, on that stripe in the middle of the salmon, there seem to be elements in there that can detect a magnetic field.
Wow. Good GPS.
Yes. Maybe we should all have a salmon in our car.
And sometimes I think we do, if we only learn how to pay attention to it, you know. My thought being that we've learned how not to pay attention to a lot of our senses. And, let's see. Salmon, then why do we love to eat them so much? What is it about the salmon? Ah, my goodness, they are so delicious when they're fresh out of the water. There's nothing like them.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there is this interesting thing between wild salmon and farm salmon. Now, personally, I would always prefer a wild salmon.
As long as it's fresh, or freshly caught, or freshly frozen.
Freshly frozen, yeah. You know, people don't realize it, but in most places outside of Alaska, the salmon you get are frozen.
Right.
And actually, by law, raw salmon, such as sushi, has to be frozen.
If you think about it,
law in Japan and also in the United States.
Yeah, if you think about it, having salmon that is freshly frozen is probably better than having salmon that is fresh, but is like 8 days old.
Yeah, the trick is to do a good job of thawing it.
Yep.
And to serve it immediately after thawing.
What is it about the salmon, though, that makes it so desirable to the human species? Why do we love eating it so?
Yeah. Because it tastes good.
It tastes good. Okay, well, that's where you're going, where I thought we'd go. I think it tastes good because of its fats.
Well, now, this is an interesting thing. You see, because I started to say how I prefer wild salmon to farm salmon. Increasingly, people are preferring farm salmon, and the reason is that it's fattier. And so we're going through the same evolution of our palate that we went through with meat. You know, people used to just eat game. Before the Civil War in the U.S., most meat was game. And then they started eating domestic meat, and then they got to love domestic meat, you know, a good steak, because it's just, you know, riven with all that fat, and it's got a mild flavor and a fattiness. And then if you get a piece of game, it's very lean. It doesn't have any fat, and it's got a kind of a strong taste, which prosaically we call gamey tasting.
Right.
And
so if the salmon have been eating sagebrush like deer, they're going to taste so good.
Right. Right. Well, it's a matter of taste. I mean, I really like the lean, strong taste of a sockeye. But increasingly, as people eat more and more farm salmon, a lot of people are preferring it.
Well, sure, and we, you know, kind of gravitate to what we have been eating. And one would suspect that being the case, sooner or later, we're all going to be eating Impossible Burgers because we don't know what the taste of real meat might be like. You know, you told this wonderful story about fishing and seals. And you net or get a bunch of salmon in your net.
When I was
up in Bristol Bay,
drift netting with Theo Thomas
in
the Gulf of Alaska.
Yeah.
So we put out a net, and you know, it's a big deal. You got to go out there, you know, way ahead of the opening time to get a good spot. So we were out there all night bobbing around waiting for the opening. We got the opening, we put out a net. The sockeye hit the net. We had a whole net full of sockeye, and then four seals came, ate them all.
But they didn't eat all of the salmon.
No, they generally just grab the belly.
Ah, that's what I was getting at, the belly.
So you know what you're losing, because you're hauling the net, and there's all the fish minus their bellies. So
and what is it about the belly?
It's just their favorite part.
It's got the fats, doesn't it?
I mean, there were some animals that prefer the head.
Where the brains is. Well, I tell you, I prefer that belly. Oh, my goodness. It just melts in your mouth.
Fish belly of any kind. I mean, tuna belly is just the best part of the tuna.
Yeah. Well, with respect to one fish, two fisheries would be the caption here. There are two fisheries. There's the wild fishery, and then there's the farmed fishery. But first of all, what happened to the Atlantic salmon fishery?
Well, at this point, there is almost no commercial fishing of Atlantic salmon. And yet, the salmon stock keeps declining. There are about 1.5 million Atlantic salmon left in the world. And when you consider that in a good year, about 60 million sockeye go into Bristol Bay, 1.5 million, not a lot.
And in the whole Atlantic Ocean?
Yes. Yes.
Norway to Halifax?
Canada. Yes.
Wow.
And what's happening is climate change. The carbon dioxide loves water. So about a third of the carbon dioxide that is produced on land ends up in the ocean, where it impacts on the hydrogen content, which reduces the ability of certain organisms to grow, like zooplankton and small fish like capelin. And, you know, this is the stuff that large fish like salmon and cod feed on. So what's happening is the salmon go to sea, and a lot of them don't get enough nutrition to ever make it back. So what I'm saying here is that the oceans are losing their carrying capacity. They're losing their ability to feed the animals that live in the ocean. This is like the scariest thing I've ever learned.
Even scarier than the Made in China virus?
Yes.
Even scarier than that?
Yes. You know, I keep thinking about, you know, how people's response to this virus. And I think, why can't we get them to respond to climate change in the same way?
In the
long run, climate change, if it's not stopped, is going to be even worse than this.
Well, one way is to tell the story of the salmon.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is exactly what we're doing here today. And the impact of the salmon the impact of the environment on the salmon, which is how you ended up with a book entitled Salmon, A Fish, the Earth, and the History of Their Common Fate. You know, it sounds so ominous, the history of their common fate. It sounds like we all got, you know, guillotined or something.
Well, it is ominous. You know, we have to fix things, we have to change things, or, you know, as the expression goes, we're done for, you know?
There you go. Well, we'll pick that up when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Oh, we're eating salmon today. Or at least we're eating the book Salmon by Mark Kurlansky. It tastes pretty good. It has lots of pretty pictures in it, enough to keep you going for hours and hours and hours, and great stories. So what could be more fun than eating a book on salmon? Maybe reading it. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's KNOX, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. Business Money To Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money To Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. businessmoneytogo.com. Cod.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, one fish, two fisheries. We fish them as we have for, I don't know, how long have we been fishing for salmon, Mark?
Well, thousands of years.
Thousands of years. And now we're farming them.
Prehistoric people were fishing for salmon.
And now we're farming them, and we haven't been doing that very long.
No. No. Since the 1970s. Yeah. Norwegians started it.
So you painted a picture of two wild salmon fisheries in Alaska. Two people, I guess both of them were fishing for sockeye, weren't they?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. A little bit about the sockeye as compared to the king salmon we have down in California or the Chinook.
Yeah. King has a somewhat more southern range.
Mm-hmm.
And is slightly larger. Sockeye, after they're born, they grow in lakes. So you only find sockeye runs near lakes.
Ah. So they have a place to grow up a little bit.
Yeah, and when they come back and they spawn, I was talking about this metamorphosis that takes place. In no salmon is it more spectacular than in the sockeye, which are bright, bright red, have this huge hump. It sort of distorts their face. They get kind of buck teeth and the hook nose and very strange-looking creatures.
And that's at the end of the run, their spawning run.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So catching them is all done right at the mouth of the river or just outside the river, and it's tightly regulated. And one of the interesting things about salmon is that their time is fixed. So,
let me just clarify this about catching. You don't want to catch them in the river. You want to leave the ones in the river alone because they're on their way to spawn.
Okay.
But after you have enough that have gone in the river to spawn, then the fishermen are allowed to catch some just outside of the river.
Okay, good. Then one of the interesting things I was pointing out is that the timing on this salmon's life cycle is really fixed almost to the day, is it not?
Yes. Yes.
So we can keep track of things. You know, we're going to know, well, this is when they spawn, this is when they left, and then we're going to know
when
they come back.
Well, yeah, but you know, it's not really different for different species, but it's different for different rivers.
Right.
As I was saying, the salmon, even of the same species, are considerably modified depending on what river they live in. So that actually, if you had two Chinook or two sockeye, two salmon of the same species in two different rivers, their DNA is more different than yours and mine.
Wow. Different fish, different people.
Yep.
Then,
I mean, you would look at them and they would look the same.
Mm-hmm. Are most of the catches done via nets, commercial fishermen?
Yes.
Okay.
See, the thing about a salmon is that a salmon always swims. They all swim with great determination in one direction. So that makes netting
a fatal flaw, right?
Right.
They don't know when to turn around.
Right.
They just keep going to where they need to go, and that's how you catch them. What happened, what was the discovery, the technological breakthrough that led to salmon farming?
I don't know that there was a specific breakthrough. They just discovered that you could keep salmon in a pen and you could breed them and keep breeding them for a certain kind of fish that was suitable for that. Basically, they're just bred to grow fast.
Mm-hmm.
They're just fast-growing, dumb fish.
What do we feed them in those pens?
Well, that is a problem. When I wrote Cod, I was completely opposed to fish farming, and one of the reasons was that they were feeding them wild fish, usually stuff scooped up by factory trawlers, and you know, so that when you ate a farmed fish, you'd actually killed more wild fish than if you just ate a wild fish. But the thing about fish farmers is that they really wanted to be the good guys. They thought they were going to be the good guys, and you know, they're Scandinavians. They're very disappointed that they're not, and so they do actually try to fix things. And one of the things they're trying to fix is the feed. So now the feed is only about 50% fish. A lot of it is soy, non-GMO soy, so it'll sell in Europe. And they're doing lots of interesting high-tech science to develop new kinds of proteins to feed them.
So essentially, they're going to be eating Impossible Burgers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the problem they're dealing with is that the more fish content in their meal, the better they are. So, you know, it's kind of like,
you know, any other confined animal feeding operation, cows or cattle or hogs or chickens, what have you, they kind of are what they eat.
Yeah, absolutely. But they have to figure out, I mean, the whole idea was this was going to be sustainable, and it's not sustainable if they're killing lots of fish to feed them.
Right.
So this is one of the things they have to figure out.
Seems like an interesting conflict there, and I'm not sure how they're going to work that one out.
Well, there's all sorts of interesting things. There's a soldier fly, and all kinds of interesting new ways of getting protein to grow these animals.
Oh, insect protein.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see. With respect to the salmon's flesh in the wild, what we look for is that, you know, pinkish, reddish, goldish flesh color that indicates it's been living on a lot of good stuff in the ocean. But we could see the same colors in farm salmon, but it's not quite the same, is it?
It actually is.
Oh.
It's just that the reason that wild salmon have that color is because the keratin that they get from eating crustaceans and various things. And the farm salmon don't eat those things, so they don't get the keratin. Originally, farm salmon were white, and they tried to market them as white salmon. But, you know, there's a lot of research done that shows that people really choose their food by color, and people didn't want white salmon. So they feed them keratin. But they are colored by the same thing that they're colored by in nature. There's a lot of myths about this. People think that they're given food coloring and things. It's not true. They're given keratin.
So, and keratin is what, except it's not keratin from the crustaceans that the salmon that go to sea eat, correct?
It depends. Sometimes, that's what organic salmon is.
Oh, okay. Would you describe organic salmon for us?
I just did.
Just did. Okay. They're fed keratin, but they're not sprayed with glyphosate, something like that.
Yeah. No. The you know, I've talked to lots of chemists about this, about the difference between a man-made compound and a compound in nature. And every chemist I've ever talked to has said that if you have a compound, especially a simple compound that's one or two or three different elements, and you do it right, you have produced exactly what nature has produced. But the phrase that chemists keep using is a compound is a compound.
Mm-hmm. We used to hear that discussion quite a bit at the origins of the organic food industry.
Right.
Chemists would say, oh, look, nitrogen's nitrogen, and that's it. Forget it. Go away. But the people didn't go away. They just had this notion that there must be something different about it. And
yeah, but,
kept
you know,
pursuing it.
you know, sometimes there's problems in the way things are done or impurities in them. But if they're done right, you know, mm-hmm. I couldn't find a single chemist to say there was any difference if they're done right. The problem is that it's not always done right.
There you go.
Whereas nature always does it right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this whole notion that the fate of the earth and the fate of the salmon are tied together. And you may as well throw us into the net too, I reckon, because we all live on this planet Earth here. What can we do, Mark Kurlansky? You've looked at this. You've lived it. You've been around the world chasing it. And you have this overall sense of dread.
Well, you know, I looked at the whole history of salmon, you know, going back to the Romans and even before. And, you know, you see certain consistent things, like it was very clear from early on that blocking rivers was a really bad thing. And there were all sorts of ordinances against blocking rivers. The Middle Ages had lots of ordinances against it. The Magna Carta specifies that the King of England cannot block a salmon river. This was the principal problem they dealt with until the Industrial Revolution. In the Industrial Revolution, they wanted, of course, to build factories for industry, and they built these factories on riverbanks. Building on riverbanks to begin with is bad, but they powered them through dams, which blocked the rivers, and the dams powered the factory, and then the factory dumped its pollutants in the river. So that England, by fairly early in the Industrial Revolution, had managed to kill all its rivers. Then you look at New England, and British people and people of British origin in New England did the exact same thing. Built the factories, built the dams, polluted the rivers, killed the whole thing.
Did not nobody notice?
Well, wait a second. I'll get to this.
Okay.
So then you look at the Pacific Northwest, and, you know, who was it? It was New Englanders who first had this idea that if we dam the rivers, we can create a lot of power, and we can build an economy here. And so, you know, I'm looking at this whole thing, and I'm thinking, as you were just doing, why don't they learn anything? And then I realized, because there's nothing for them to learn. They're doing what they want to do. The point that we're missing is that Britain became the greatest industrial power in the world. New England became the industrial center of North America. The Pacific Northwest, which had no economy, has this booming economy because it produces more electricity than any other place in the world. And these are all success stories. So,
and now look at China.
Well, so what you come up with, what you learn from all this, is that our whole model of economic development is wrong. We have an idea of economic development that destroys nature and destroys the planet, and that's not how we should be developing economies. And, you know, the proof of that is that in times of economic depression, carbon emissions decline. And when there is so-called prosperity, carbon emissions go way up. So, like, this virus is it's really good for the environment, you know. It's slowing down carbon emissions and pollution. And so, you know, we have this whole concept of economic development that's destructive. So a lot of people, you know, put it as an either-or thing. This is a favorite Republican argument that, you know, you can't have environmental measures because it's taking away jobs. This is a completely false argument. There's nothing that says that jobs have to be destructive to the environment. You just have to do things in a way that is not destructive. And that's what we have to change.
Well, can you point to a model that would let us know how that would work?
There are some places where dams are being torn down, and alternative energies are being used. You know, farming practices don't have to be destructive to land or to rivers. There are alternatives to pesticides.
All of these require really smart people who are really dedicated on finding a new way of doing them.
Well, we are smart people, you know. We just haven't been using our brains in the right way. I mean, you know, it takes a lot of brains to invent hydroelectric dams.
And to get really big brains that are really smart, one of the best things we can do is eat a lot of salmon.
Yes, then we'll be smarter.
Then we'll be smarter and we'll know what kind of big trouble we're getting ourselves. Well, wow.
That's a bear's point of view.
That's a bear's point of view. I guess we have to, I'm a bear kind of guy. I watched the bear standing next to the river and reaching out and grabbing a salmon that's leaping through the air and turning away from the river and wandering off into the woods to have this wonderful salmon dinner. Mark Kurlansky, author, Salmon, a Fish, the Earth and the History of Their Common Fate. Thank you for joining us so much. Wow. Folks, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thanks, Mark, for joining us. Really appreciate
pleasure
it.
Pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.